योऽन्तःप्रविश्य मम वाचमिमां प्रसुप्तां सञ्जीवयति अखिलशक्तिधरस्वधाम्ना अन्यांश्च हस्तचरणश्रवणत्वगादीन् प्राणान् नमो भगवते पुरुषाय तुभ्यम्। गुड मॉर्निंग। टुडेज टॉपिक इज ए वेरी सिंपल टॉपिक, इट इज व्हाई बुद्धा मैटर्स टुडे। इट्स ए वेरी इंटरेस्टिंग सब्जेक्ट। Historically, Buddha is the only great religious teacher who was not religious in the true sense of that term. It may appear to be a bit of a contradiction. He did not believe in a god or any divine entities. But today, if you read books on Buddhism, you can see pictures of different celestial deities, angels and so on. But he himself did not believe in anything transcendental, and also he denied himself having any connection with anything transcendental. This down-to-earth approach is unique to Buddhism. So you can believe in Buddhism without becoming a Buddhist in the traditional sense. And he believed in one simple principle: be a good human being. I think it was in the context of his discussion on Buddha that Swami Vivekananda made a very well-known statement: you live your life in such a way that God will accept you even if you don't accept him. Because Buddhism is essentially an agnostic religion, but is deeply spiritual. Maybe his whole life, his whole philosophy of life, in fact, you are not a philosopher, but his whole philosophy of life was a demonstration of the fact that you can be spiritual without being religious. You don't find these examples. It's an interesting paradox. He himself eventually became a deity. There are many, many temples. The deity, the main installed deity in many Buddhist places of worship. But he himself did not want to be a deity and did not believe in any deity. And he just asked you some simple questions. How do you get peace of mind? And his teachings have been, unfortunately, very badly misunderstood by those who perhaps didn't have access to these original teachings, either in the Theravada tradition of Tripitakas or in the Mahayana tradition of Shunyavada, Vijnanavada, philosophical systems. Today, if you go to a library, you find hundreds of, or thousands actually, of works on Buddhism, and there are tens of thousands of manuscripts stored in different manuscript libraries in India and abroad on Buddhism, but at the same time, he himself did not write a book. So whatever we come to know Buddhism as it's today comes from a very accidental incident. It's called the First Buddhist Council. That took place less than 50 years after his passing away. He passed away in 460 BC. He was born in 580 BC. Sorry, the other way around. It's BC, you know. So he was born in 560 BC and passed away in 480 BC. I mean 80 years. So you have to count backward. In 580 years before Christ, he was born. And he passed away 460 years before Christ. So this is a story. Anyway, I'm not going to the details. And Buddha is supposed to belong to the earlier actual age, which is a particular age which is characterized by a number of great men who were born. Maybe it begins somewhere at the middle of the 1st century BC, going up to the 8th century BC, called actual age, according to historians. It is not a very universally accepted doctrine, but it's a bit of an arbitrary, analysis of historical events. So coming back to Buddhism. First, he believed that this life in this world that we find today is okay, but it's not complete. There is still scope for room for improvement. And this incompleteness he called dukkha. Unfortunately, the word dukkha is being very badly misunderstood, because when a great teaching coming from an ancient teacher, when it travels away from its own original sources, then it travels the distance, different continents, countries and cultures, they get localized interpretations. I can give an example from Buddha's own life, how he developed this idea of dukkha or incompleteness or imperfection. He called Pratitya Samutpada, the 12-point link which in a way indicates the cyclic journey of a soul, birth, life, which includes a lot of sufferings and a lot of momentary enjoyments, death and rebirth. This cycle is called Pratitya Samutpada. Is analyzed in the light of these 12 links. So, Buddha was born as a prince, as you know. He was born in what is now Nepal, which is a part of an empire. It's called the Magadha Empire in India, and this Lumbini, there's a city where he was born, Kapilavastu, all these places were parts of that Magadha Empire. The capital was near what is now called Patna in the state of Bihar. At that time it was called Rajagriha, later became Pataliputra, now it's called Patna. That's the capital, and is extension was what is now called Nepal. So he was a prince. It is said, that's a bit of a mythology, his father called an astrologer. It's a common practice in ancient India to find out what's going to happen to this little child who's born, whether he become a worthy successor to the king or not. So the astrologer predicted he became an emperor. Then he said he'll become an emperor of this world, or he'll become an emperor of the other world. Becoming an emperor of this world is like becoming a Napoleon Bonaparte. Becoming an emperor of the other world is like becoming a Buddha, which actually became a great ascetic teacher, spiritual teacher. So his father made sure that the child had no access, no understanding of the problems in this world. So if poverty, death, illness, sickness, suddenly you find good information that your near and dear has passed away, your close friend has passed away, brother has passed away. Suddenly you get shocked. That also reflects a sad but unavoidable possibility in human life. So the child should not have any access to any problems in this world. Poverty, starvation, death, sickness, old age, or anything. He should not even see an old man, or a sick man, or a dead body, or a starving person, absolutely protected, imprisoned by his own luxury. That was the life he was living. And when he was almost 28 years old, by the time he had married a great woman, he eventually became his own disciple and nun, and his son was also a worthy son, Rahula, his name. So anyway, at that time, one of his charioteers took him for a ride outside the city, in the streets. So as they were traveling, Buddha happened to see three real pictures of the darker side of human existence. A dead body being taken to the cremation ground, accompanied by people, wife, children and others grieving, crying and weeping. were shocked. Then he saw a sick man sitting somewhere in a street corner with sickness, death and sickness. And then he's a very old person who could hardly walk. So what's the matter? I'm quite healthy and strong. This man is different. He looks old. He can't move. The other one is sick. What's the matter? Is there such a thing in this world as sickness, old age and death? Then he saw another picture, a saint, a Hindu saint, sitting in a street corner. He was old, apparently sick, but he was full of joy, full of serenity. So he wanted to be like him, the last vision. He came back, returned home. Whole night he spent thinking about what he saw that day. It shocked him. Is there such a thing as old age, death and sickness? So life is not complete. Life is not perfect. Everyone is not going to live like me. In a palace surrounded by luxuries, son of a king, so many courtiers, servants and others. There is another aspect, another side of human existence, another human life. And he left his kingdom, his comforts, his palace, his country, and put on the garb of an ascetic and started walking. It's almost 1300 miles. Right now there are roads which could take you there in a few hours, but in early days there were only, you remember, this was long before the Roman roads were constructed. This is 6th century BC, remember. So there was only narrow pathways move along the thick forest, found mountains and rivers and so on. And it traveled, he said, 1300 miles. Travel and reach what is now called Bodh Gaya, which again the state of Bihar, which was at that time the most extensive empire in India at that time. Its northern frontiers were in Kazakhstan, in Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and other places. Its northern frontier. Eastern frontier included Burma, and southern frontier included Sri Lanka, and western frontier included Afghanistan. That was the extent of the empire called Emperor Bindusara. That is the name of the emperor during Buddha's time, or Magadha Empire. So anyway, the story goes like this. So he walked and reached this place, Bodh Gaya, and sat under a tree. So the Sanskrit chronicler of Buddha's life, Sughosha, 2nd century AD, he describes his own Sanskrit language, Buddha's strong resolve, determination, the purpose, the intention. He told himself while sitting under the tree to meditate, to find out the source of this incompleteness, which we now call dukkha. So I must first of all request you to remove from your mind the idea of grief and sorrow and sadness and tragedy that are frequently associated with Buddha's dukkha word. Dukkha means something incomplete. Well, if you are a very rich person, and when you find a richer person, you feel dukkha because you feel there is somebody who is richer than you. So you are not complete in your riches. You are a strong person, you find somebody stronger than you. So you feel dukkha. In that sense, the word could be justified. But dukkha actually means the conviction that you have something, but that's not the whole picture. There is much more to it. So you feel that what you know right now is incomplete or is imperfect. Out of that, you develop a strong desire, urge for something that is complete. That emotional sentiment is what is called dukkha. That's a real meaning of dukkha. So if you look at the dictionary, you may feel Buddha was crying and weeping when he was walking from his palace to Bodh Gaya. No. Because you know what he said himself? Ihasane shushyudu me sharidam tugamsti mamsam chavlai vilecha yadhu aprapya siddhim bhuhu janma durlabham naivasanath kaya madas chalishyate. This is the verse that is from the chronicler, Buddha's first historian. It's a literary classic. He wrote in verses. What it means is, I am going to sit under this tree. Let my body perish. Let my body be reduced to bones, marrow. Let it completely perish. I won't get up from the seat before and without realizing the supreme truth of human existence, which could be realized, could be understood only by spiritual practices extending several life cycles. That's a literal translation. Bahu janma durlabham. Difficult to obtain even if you work hard, struggle hard for several life cycles. That's a literal meaning. So this was his resolve. So when he was walking from his palace to Bodh Gaya, he was fully convinced of the incompleteness, the imperfection of all the money, the stock markets, your bank balance, your big position as a CEO, your big car, all that you can think of, things that you have accomplished in this life, they are incomplete. And out of this conviction of incompleteness comes the urge for something that is more transcendental, that could be the answer to these problems in this world, which he put together under the one word, dukkha. So dukkha is not grief. You can justify the sense that the dukkha is possible only when you are already spiritually evolved, this kind of dukkha. In the Yoga Sutra, remember many of the commentators of Yoga Sutra were Buddhist actually. The Yogacara system got a name because many of the Yogacara philosophers like Asanga, Vasubandhu wrote Vijnapti Matrava Siddhi Yoga, that's Vasubandhu, and his brother Asanga wrote Yogacara Bhumi. These are two important texts, ancient texts in Sanskrit language on Yogacara philosophy. They were great practitioners of yoga, so they wrote many books on yoga. And in their books, they write that this dukkha is possible only for those who are spiritually evolved. See, unless you're already evolved to some extent, you won't feel, well, I don't want any more money. It's just enough. I don't want any more cars. It's enough. I don't want to get richer. It's enough. The answer that your own strong resolve to say no to yourself, or enough, no more to yourself, that comes from a very high level of spiritual evolution, which Buddha had reached. So that feeling of incompleteness of what you already have is called dukkha. So he talks about chatvari arya satyani, four noble truths. The word arya in Sanskrit language means noble, broad-minded, spiritually evolved. That's the meaning of arya word. So mahakula kulina arya sadbhya sajjana satavaha aryaha. This is the definition of the word arya that comes from the first dictionary regular dictionary. Dictionaries existed in the 8th century BC in Sanskrit, Niruktam, Vaidika, Nikhandu, and this was incomplete. The real dictionary in modern Sanskrit language goes to 1st century AD. It is called Amarakosha, otherwise Amarasimha. So Amarakosha defined the word Arya as something that makes you noble, broad-minded, spiritually exalted, civilized, cultured, That's the meaning of the word Arya, Mahakula, Kulina Aryaha. Somebody who belongs to that group of people who are highly educated, cultured, refined, sophisticated, spiritually exalted. Sadhya, those who are of a sattvic nature, truthfulness, humility, compassion, sympathy for even that. Sadhava, I mean those who are also spiritual seekers. So he talks about four noble truths, four truths, four convictions that come to any person who is struggling in spiritual life. The first one is the truth of suffering, dukkha. I mean, as we life that we normally live in this world has a lot of problems like suffering, dissatisfaction, stress, impermanence, incompleteness. You are born, that is certainly very good. You grow, you evolve, and then you get old, which is very unpleasant, which again the first glimpse of incompleteness or dukkha, and then die. That is also dukkha, incompleteness, not very, not absolutely something that should be left behind in your pursuit of a higher ideal. So life, birth, all these things are essentially incomplete in nature because they fall short of the highest ideal of human existence. That is the first dukkha. The second one is there's a cause for this dukkha. It comes from attachment, desire, called trishna in Sanskrit, called tanha in Pali. So Buddha, one important thing that's about Buddha is he was a very great man of the masses, down to earth. In those days, in the 7th century BC, great scholars, great monks, great sages only spoke and wrote in Sanskrit. But Buddha was a great scholar in Sanskrit, as every prince should be in those days. But he lived and he talked in the language of the common masses, which is a very, very raw, evolute, a vernacular form of Sanskrit, maybe cruder form of Sanskrit called Prakrit, the spoken form. And his script is called Pali. So you find, for example, Tripitakas, Sutta Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, Abhidhamma Pitaka. When Buddha passed away, after 50 years of his passing away, when they had the first Buddhist council in Rajagriha, as again in today's Bihar state, all the monks and nuns from different places assembled there and they recited what they heard from Buddha and they literally recorded in their mind what they heard from Buddha and they recited and these were putting book form, manuscript form in Pali script. So Vinaya Pitaka, the Sutta Pitaka, Abhidhamma Pitaka, all these are written in Pali script, including Dhammapada is part of Sutta Pitaka, is in Pali. So the word tanha is Pali, trishna in Sanskrit. So this clinging to possessions, pleasures, ideas, obsessions, desires, all these constitute the cause of suffering. When you live in this world full of desires, you struggle to fulfill those desires and you don't succeed in that, and when you die, then you will be reborn, you'll be born in a family, in a body, in a place, in a culture, which will scope for fulfilling your unfulfilled desires of this life. So every new birth is an opportunity and is caused by previous desires, an opportunity to fulfill the unfulfilled desires and expectations of this life. So this trishna, this desire, clinging, I want to enjoy this, I want to enjoy that. If that is accumulated in the system, when you die, that desire will be there, and you will seek a body, a set of circumstances where you can fulfill those desires. That's the dynamics of rebirth. Shankaracharya, later on 8th century, he gave a very well-known analysis of this process. In a Tadantara Pratipattu, Ramhadi Samparishaktaha Prasna Rupanabhyam. How human body, when you left behind, it carries with you a baggage. You cannot, no, I don't want this bag, no. You'll be put in your pocket and you are born again with this baggage. What is the baggage? What does it contain? It contains all your samskaras, all your unfulfilled desires and expectations. So, the mother of all these desires is Trishna or Tanha in Pali. Buddha says this is the cause of suffering, because the cause of rebirth. Life means suffering. Again, suffering is a translation in English, which is not even an approximation. Actually, it is a violation of the actual sense in which the word dukkha was used by Buddha. But we can't help it. We already traveled 2600 years from Buddha's life. So we can't go back and then ask him, you should correct it. No. The word dukkha doesn't mean suffering, but that's the word used normally in English language, in all translations. So the truth and how to put an end to this suffering? By eliminating this desire. Ignorance, all that. And this state of liberation from the suffering is called nirvana. Nirvana is something like this. Well, you know, suppose you have a lamp, and when the oil is completely drained off, removed from the lamp, the light gets extinguished. Because there is no lamp or light when the oil is completely gone. Or a fire, it means firewood is completely gone, exhausted. Then there is no more fire. If there is trishna, if there is desire, then this lamp of life, rebirth, and this cycle of samsara, Buddha uses the word samsara, it's a very important term, Buddha. So this can be eliminated by getting rid of, by putting an end to this trishna or desire. Desire, you know, unfulfilled desire. That is the real sense of tanha, trishna. There's a great difference between meaning and sense. It's an important principle in philology, linguistics, everywhere. There's a great difference between sense and meaning. A sense is what strikes you even if you don't understand the meaning of the word. There are many words which can mean a lot of things for us. If you look at the dictionary, it'll be different. The dictionary meaning will be very inadequate. The same is true for the word dukkha also. And now, what's a way out of this suffering? It is called nirvana. The truth of the path leading to the end of the suffering, the way to end all, is called Noble Eightfold Path. Ashtanga Marga, it is called. So in other words, four noble truths. Dukkha exists. Dukkha is a cause. Dukkha can come to an end. And there is a way for dukkha to be transcended. And the way is nirvana. And how to attain nirvana? The right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, I will explain this in detail. The greatness of Buddha is, in this modern age, he doesn't ask you to go to a place every day and pray to a god whom You have no possibility of ever seeing with your own eyes. You are asked to believe in. I'm also remember be a believer in God. So I'm not an agnostic or anything, but I'm just trying to emphasize the relevance, the practicality of Buddha's teachings in our own times. So human civilization, culture, this modern age, science, technology, all these new developments, you know. People may not have time or patience to listen to somebody who will tell you there is somebody sitting there above the clouds and you have to believe in him, but you can't see him. He can see you. And he is closely watching you, what you are going to do, what you are not going to do. And he has a big stick in his hand. And he has two possibilities he presents before you, hell or heaven. If you don't listen to him and worship him exactly as he has recommended 2000 years ago, 1400 years ago, then remember, this is the place, hell, where you suffer, cry, weep, suffer, and so on. But if you listen to him closely, exactly, if you read the book and believe that comma is actually coming from God, the semicolon is coming from the God, he wrote it, the word, the phoneme, the syllables, the consonants, the vowels, the entire linguistic, philological mechanism is given by him. And listen to him very carefully. And he finished writing 1400 years ago. Every comma is coming from him. He's divine. And you may be a crook, a criminal in the world, but if you listen to him, obey him, fine, everything is fine. You may be Hitler, you'll go to heaven if you listen to him. You may be Buddha, you'll go to hell because you don't belong to him, because you don't listen to him. Now, in such a situation, Buddha is very, very relevant. Buddha is the only relevant religion. I would say Buddhism and Advaita. You know, I'm not including popular Hinduism, because popular Hinduism also tells you go to a temple, do rituals, perform puja. It has many wonderful results. If you don't do, there will be some difficulties. It's a popular Hinduism also say the same, just like Brahmic religions. But Shankaracharya's Advaita tells you, don't worry about a place or book or temples or rituals, beliefs. You try to look upon entire humanity as one spiritual family. That is Advaita. Vasudeva Kutumbakam. So humanity is one, spiritually one family. So Siddhanta Vyavasthasu Dvaitiro Nishchidadudam Parasparam Viruddhyandi Tai Ayanna Viruddhyandi. The 6th century, 6th AD, Gaudapada's writing. Shankaracharya said, we had no quarrel with anyone, not even with the agnostics, because everyone is an expression of the divine, only he doesn't realize this. We can't hurt anyone in this world. We cannot worship God in the temple and then hate everyone outside. Can't do that. If there is such a God, and then you say, I believe in that God, and you do terrible things, it's a bad publicity for that God. The God will be ashamed to come in public, but this fellow is taking my name and he does all the terrible things, better keep indoors. But Shankaracharya says, if you believe in God, then you should be a good human being. You should treat every living creature in this world as one spiritual family. You cannot cut a tree and call yourself spiritual. You cannot hurt an ant and call yourself spiritual. You cannot worship God in one place and then hate other people. You can't do that. If there is God, that God will be the God of everyone. He is present in everyone, present everywhere. So that's the Advaitic idea of God. And Buddhism. These two religions, I believe, ideas are very relevant in modern times. Because they don't ask you questions. They simply tell you, become a good human being. Now, how does he teach this idea? The first of this eightfold discipline is Samyak Drishti, the right view, right understanding, right action. Understand that everything in this world that you call enjoyments, It's okay, but it's impermanent. It is for you. So when you are working hard to achieve something, and you will do anything to achieve that, somebody tells you, you can certainly achieve that, absolutely, there's no problem, but it also is going to disappear one day. Then your obsession, your greed will come down. So in Buddha's teachings, these Eightfold Noble Paths, there are three important aspects. One is wisdom, the other is ethics, third one is our discipline, mental, spiritual discipline. So the first one, he called Panna or Prajna. Prajna is Sanskrit, Panna is in Pali. The first principle in the spiritual wisdom is the right view, the right understanding, the right outlook, the right way of looking at our life, which also includes the right way of looking at everyone else in this world, everything else in this world. And remember, there is something very interesting, something is found in Advaita and also in Buddhism, that is the fundamental belief that all material achievements may be necessary, but they are essentially impermanent. We can work for it, absolutely no problem, but then you should not go beyond the limit in your obsession, because it is not going to remain there for too long. So keep that in mind and try to be a rich person. Remember, you won't carry your checkbook and fountain pen with you when your body is put for cremation, the crematorium. It will be gone. You will be leaving everything behind. You can imagine modern times, people who do terrible things for money and wealth and status and domination. If they are told, well, you can certainly aspire to be an exalted, a big CEO, very rich person, no problem. But remember, one day you have to leave all this behind. Intellectually, we know, but this intellectual information we are not able to convert into common sense. You know, common sense is something that we wield. Philosophy is something that we keep in our room. Common sense is an instrument, a tool that we wield and use in our everyday life. So anyone, as Buddha says, got the samyak drishti. You may aspire to become the richest industrialist in this world, the most powerful CEO in the world, absolutely competition, all rivalry, hostility and so on. But if you tell that person, as Buddha wants to tell us, all right, fine, but these things also will one day disappear because they are essentially impermanent. That can certainly bring down this level of complexity, competition, this mindless, heartless, inhuman competition can be brought down once we realize the fundamental impermanence. That's called samyak drishti, or the right view, the right approach, the right way of understanding the essence of human existence or everything else in this world. That is the right view. That is the first teaching that Buddha wants to give us. That's again Advaita, Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. Mithyatvam also means, well, try to be the richest man in the world, but remember, you won't be taking with you your passbook and fountain pen and checkbook when your body is put to the crematorium. You have to leave that behind. So if that tells you, all right, then I'm not going to take it with me, then let me restrain myself from doing too many terrible things. So that kind of self-restraint, that is called samyak drishti. Very modern and psychologically very profound. The second teaching is the right thought. The right thought is the source of right view. In other words, samyak sankalpa, the right thought, the right mental ideas is the mother of samyak drishti, because how we look at this world and our own life depends upon what we think about ourselves and our own life. These are two aspects of prajna or panna, wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Discipline. Then the ethics, sammik vak, sammik karma, sammik ajiva. Next one is lies, harsh speech, gossip, divisive. Some people sometimes think, I am very outspoken person. I am very, very, very frank. That's not a compliment. That's a problem actually. If you open your mind and say whatever comes to your mind and say, I am very proud of it, it's absolute stupidity. Buddha tells you, you should practice self-restraint, self-control. In the word that you use, the sentence that you use, if you hurt somebody by a word, that is also himsa, violence. You are murdering other person mentally, emotionally, intellectually. So that's what he says, the sammik vak, the right speech, harsh speech, gossip, divisive talk, and so on this earth, lying and things like that. Using language, words for a wrong purpose. According to Hindu tradition, our tongue is the throne in which the goddess of learning is seated. So goddess of learning means the power to use your language properly. Not diplomacy, because diplomacy is an artificial tool. Many diplomats die of heartbreak because there are so many multi-layers around them. They have to struggle so hard to tell lies, and that with this broad smile in a very convincing manner. So that's what Buddha is talking about. Talking what you feel within, but without hurting anyone. There are long writings on this subject in the Tripitaka tradition, which I don't have time to expound right now. I've given dozens of talks on Buddhism, quoting from different scriptures, both Hinayana Theravada tradition, also Mahayana tradition, the foundation texts of Indian philosophy series, hosted by the Stanford Hindu Student Association. You can view on YouTube. The second one in ethical category is sammik karma, the right action. Non-stealing, practicing ahimsa, and also chaste life, all these are important elements of sammik karma, right action. Not doing the wrong things. Then, sammik ajiva, the right livelihood. Living in such a manner that you don't do any harm to anyone. So these are three important teachings belonging to the ethical aspects. Then the mental discipline, the right effort, sammik vyayama, sammik smriti called mindfulness, and sammik samadhi. Of this sammik vyayama, cultivate means just focus on what is necessary and avoid what is unnecessary. We should cultivate proper states of mind and avoid unpleasant states of mind. And then there is one important thing, sammik smriti, awareness of the body, feelings of mind and mental phenomena. Actually, this mindfulness is based on Satyupattana Sutta. It belongs to Khuddaka Nikaya, one of the Pali tradition, canonical tradition. It is actually the source of this sammik smriti. So, Satyupattana Sutta, Mahasatyupattana Sutta. There are two important books. Buddha used to give long discourses for the laity, for the masses. Very exhaustive, long discourses. And that came to be called as Mahasatyupattana Sutta, long discourses. What is Satyupattana Sutta, mindfulness? Sati means smriti, awareness, remembrance, awareness. How to react and respond to life situations as a whole. That is the spiritual psychology behind mindfulness. You should be aware of it. Smriti, you should be aware of it. But you should not be caught by that. You should not be trapped. Suppose you encounter a life situation, a difficult situation, and you become obsessed with that, you become attached. If there is an unpleasant situation, we respond to it very violently. Or there is a pleasant situation, happy situation, we respond to it with great obsessive liking. Raga dvesha, extreme aversion to certain things, extreme liking, obsession, attachment to certain things. Two sides of the same attachment. That should be avoided. So how to avoid getting trapped by extreme aversion or by extreme obsessive attachment? You should be aware of it. And when you become aware of the problem, then mentally you detach yourself from it. If you are not aware, it will catch you. It will imprison you. But if you are aware and also you are attached to it, you are drawn towards it, then you are trapped, you are imprisoned. And if you also hate something, then also you are trapped and imprisoned. You are entangled. So how to remain free from entanglement? How to remain free from being imprisoned? You should be aware of it. But you should also remind yourself, these things come and go because they are impermanent. So that is the tool that Buddha actually used in Edi's discussion. So Satipatthana Sutta is the shorter one. It is still available in print form. Anyone can buy that. It's in Pali language. So Smriti Upasthana Sutram, very Sanskrit form, means you should be aware of it. At the same time, we should remain free from entanglement. Normally, when we are aware of something, we start a liking for it. Or if you don't like it, you dislike it. Both become obsessive feelings, obsessive attitudes, and both will have the effect of entangling or trapping us, imprisoning us. So one should be aware of it, but mentally remain detached. And that is what Buddha recommended. One of the most profound teachings in modern psychology. In Vedanta we call Sakshi. You should be witness. A witness cannot be part of it. If you are called a witness in a court of law, you should not be involved of an incident of which you are a witness. At the same time, you should be aware of it. You should be present, you should be informed, you should be aware of it, but you should not be involved. So that's the mental technique that Buddha recommended. Sammit Smriti. And that is very profound because human life becomes such a problem because we accumulate lot of things in our mental system. Tendencies, impressions, memories, obsessions, likes and dislikes, which again manifest as anxieties and worries and depressions and so on. So we can empty our mind of all the garbage, of all the toxic material, and keep it clean so that mind becomes a friend if we practice mindfulness. Sammik Smriti, Buddha called it. That's the second part of the mental discipline. The third one is Sammik Samadhi, practice meditation, which is spiritual discipline. Now Buddha says, this will help us to remain calm and quiet and at the same time with a serene state of mind. And I believe Buddha's teachings in modern times, devoid of any external rituals or any kind of fanatical, theological exteriors, you know, strong belief, dogmas and doctrines, you did, you do this, you don't do that. That may not be very much to the liking of people with independent outlook. So any person, even a non-believer, but if it's a humanist, any person who has some fundamental humanistic impulses, he wants to live a good life in this world. He doesn't want to harm anyone. He wants himself to be a happy, good person, that's all. Buddhism is the right answer. Vivekananda mentioned that Buddhism is nothing but the humanistic interpretation of Upanishadic philosophy. In the Upanishads of Vedanta, you find a lot of heavy ontological, metaphysical doctrines. A lot of theology and philosophy and metaphysics you find. If you are interested, that's a wonderful thing. But people living modern times, especially in the IT area, you know, people get exhausted. When they work for 16 hours in a computer laboratory in an IT firm, or you work with AI. Actually, the more we work AI, we get dehumanized. It has got the effect of dehumanizing. We get mentally and emotionally exhausted when we always work with machines. Then we want something simple, something sensible, something that we can practice without too much of a domination of rules and regulations and dogmatism. Buddhism comes as a simple, handy tool. He simply says, well, this world, you live in this world, but remember, the world is not always a blessing. It can be a blessing, but you should be aware of certain problems. When you're aware of that, it's a blessing. You can have all the good things in this world, use science and technology for positive purposes. At the same time, we should remain alert about taking care of the health of mind, because mental health is the most precious thing in modern age, modern times, and Buddhism is a wonderful tonic for maintaining our mental health. Thank you. Om Shanti, 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat, Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.